to everybody. Thank you for coming. So we are here for the reading of Dr. Neil Hall, the poet of human rights. I'm just say just a few words to, you know, not to introduce Dr. Hall, but just to tell something about the center that is hosting this this meeting today. For those who are not familiar with our institution, the center is the Human Rights Center of the University of Padua. It was established many years ago within the university, one of the first to be created within an academic institution in Europe. And now, after several decades of activity, the center is supporting many activities, many initiatives in the field of human rights, mainly in the area of education, of course. We support the programs of the bachelor degrees in human rights, in political science, international relations, and human rights, the master's degree in human rights and multi-level governance, and the PhD, the doctorate, the doctoral you know, degree in human rights, society, and multi-level governance. Sorry, but there is a combination of human rights and other things that sometimes make you confused. So we are very glad and honored to host for these 2 days in Padua Dr. Neil Hall. And we are also grateful to Professor Francesca Diano, who is the translator of Neil Hall, that will now introduce the figure of Neil Hall, and also perhaps participate to the debate and introduce later on the discussion that we are going to have with Neil Hall about his poetry, about his role of not only a poet but a human rights activist, maybe I would say. So I give the floor to Francesca Diano for this short introduction. Well, the idea is to have, first of all, a reading of the poems of Neil Hall, and then some space for a debate, for questions and answers about the contents of the poem, and the experience that Dr. Neil Hall is having in this specific field. So thanks a lot again, and you have the floor, please.
Thanks to you. Thank you very much to Professor Masha, who so generously immediately agreed in hosting this meeting with Neil Hall, and to the Departments of Human Rights, of course. I will be obviously very, very short in my speech, because all space should be given to this not only great poet, but great human being who really believes in the defense of human rights. And his life has been devoted to this. As you will probably have read, he doesn't practice anymore, but he is a medical doctor, an ophthalmologist, and he practiced for many years, but then he decided to devote all his life to poetry and human rights. And one of the main features of Neil, which I met only a few months ago, actually, we met in an international poetry festival, and we immediately clicked. I was fascinated, like everybody else, by his poetry, by the power of his words, and the power of his performances. He is a leader in poetry, in the sense that actually attracts the attention of whoever needs to realize how important it is to believe in himself, in his own rights, and in defending the rights of everybody. So after we met, I asked him if I could translate some of his poetry. I'm a literary translator, and I'm, well, I write poetry and other things as well. But I think that translating is, especially translating poetry, is a very, very deep way of understanding what is written. Translation is the golden path, as I say, to understanding a text, because you have to understand the text and then to render it. And so, I mean, it is the best way of understanding and getting into a text. So he was very generous with his poems, and he agreed. Then when I knew that he was coming to Italy, to Rome, with a fellowship of the American Academy, I immediately saw if it was possible to have it in Padua. And in this too, Neil has been very generous. And so he said yes. And then here it is. And so we leave all the space to Neil Hall.
My narratives are in black and white. The struggle is beyond the barriers of black and white. But my narratives are in black and white because my experiences have been within the confines of black and white. But just know that as I speak for all of us, but from my experience. Mountaintop. I've been to the mountaintop where they had me when they asked me to ask not what my country could do for me, rather what I could do for my country whilst my country was doing me. I've been to the mountaintop. Ain't nothing there but a straight drop. You see, from the hilltops of New Hampshire, from the mighty mountains of New York, to the Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, from the snow-capped Rockies to the slopes of California, there ain't no kings, no dreams, no promised land, no embracing hand, no lands of equal opportunity, no promissory note guaranteeing liberty. Ain't no freedom's ring, no we. And we, the people, my eyes can't see anything but dated niggas clinging to a nightmare, posing as their dreams. You see, you can't free nobody if your mind ain't free enough to see that their song won't sing, "Our country, 'tis of thee." That sweet land of liberty, land where my fathers died, land where from every mountaintop they say, "Let freedom ring." Well, I've been to that mountaintop. Ain't nothing there but a straight drop. We all have crosses to bear. And we can argue as to whose cross is bigger, badder, heavier. But we all bear a cross. The weight of just black. There's not the weight of black, but the immensity of being made to be just black every time white confronts me. It's the weight of white's derivation of black, a derivative definition of just black derived in part by the social conditions created in large part by whites. It is the stress and strain of an inexact, inaccurate depiction to foster an ill-conceived, preconceived description of an ill-meaning distinction of black nature, black imagery, black sounds, the scope of black. derivatives of black derived, reconstituting me by white society to be just black. It is the immensity of immediate suspicion, the first sight of me through aqua blue seas of constricting pupils, narrowing their circular misgivings like a hangman's rope hung about my black throat. It is the weight of torque and tension in muscles and tendons poised, white flight or fright, postured to telephone militarized police who serve and protect white in red line, black free zone. It is the weighted density and white tone when switching from speaking to a white to just a black. It's the lift of an entitled nose, a flaring of nostrils, a glaring view through a narrow view through slits in mistrusting eyelids. It is the enormous weight of hate when they clutch their Gucci bags, handbags, the first sight of me, the locking of the car doors, the first sight of me, the collecting of the brood frolicking in aisles of department stores, the first sight of me, the gravity of familiarity referring to me, renaming me, what's up, my man, the first they lay eyes on me. It is the insanity of in nigger black, subhuman black, green light black, to shoot blacks in the back, concealing it, tracing the slain outlines of black and crime scene tape, of plausible alibis and deniabilities, concealing falling shadows of black and lines that divide, sever white society from just black, weighted to be just black, a derivative of me derived, reconstituting me to be just black.
I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands everything, and if and in the end you will ask some questions and you need my help in translating it or the other way around, just ask. Okay.
You want to read this one too?
My name? Which one? Okay.
You want to read it?
So now, as I said, I will just give you an example of a translation. And so I will go into read in Italian my translation of My Name. This poem, there are some footnotes, I think, and this poem is inspired by some lines of the Pledge of Allegiance, and then from the a sentence which was pronounced by John Proctor in the play The Crucible, yeah. By Arthur Miller. And The Crucible, as you know, is a play dealing with that horrible thing that happened when those witches were burnt, processed and then burnt. Okay, so, Il mio nome. Ho giurato fedeltà a una bandiera issata, semiafflosciata, e alla Repubblica che non rappresenta una nazione indivisibile con libertà e giustizia per tutti. Ho recitato la preghiera del tuo Signore, al tuo Dio fatto a tua immagine, perché mi liberi dai tuoi mali. Ma sia benedetto il suo nome, nessuna volontà sia fatta per le preghiere nere sulla sua terra, né così nel suo cielo munito di porte. Io ti ho dato la mia anima, lasciami il mio nome. Dopo tutte le tribolazioni, le angosce, le paure sofferte per 8 lustri e 17 anni, il mio sangue, le lacrime, il sudore versati in ogni valle in cui mi hai abbandonato, ho cantato My country is for thee. Quando mi hai detto di cantare, ho salutato all'ultimo raggio del crepuscolo le tue larghe strisce e stelle brillanti che sventolavano sulla terra che hai dichiarato libera e patria dei prodi, ma non prodi a tal punto da lasciare che ogni uomo fosse libero. Io ti ho dato la mia anima, lasciami il mio nome. Ti ho creduto quando affermavi che Colombo, con la certa perizia del gran navigatore, salpò verso ovest per trovare l'India che sta a est e scoprì un continente che non s'era perso né teneva ad essere scoperto, abitato da uomini che non s'erano persi né tenevano ad essere scoperti, e diede loro un nuovo nome, diverso dal loro nome. Io ti ho dato la mia anima, lasciami il mio nome, perché se la libertà viene a chiamare e non ho un nome da poter chiamare, come potrò essere liberato? Lasciami il mio nome. Ti ho creduto quando hai dichiarato che Jefferson affermava con tenerezza amorevole di averla stuprata, stupro di schiave, stupro di piantagioni, stupro socio-economico, lei consenziente. Ho creduto alla tua bugia, che Washington mai disse una bugia, che si trattasse d'una guerra civile combattuta da uomini civili per liberare schiavi incivili, che Lincoln senza tensioni presiedeva in modo che questa nazione possa affermare ancora una seconda nascita di libertà, un secondo nuovo diritto di essere una nazione concepita nella libertà e votata al principio che tutti gli uomini sono creati uguali. Per questo proposito e per queste parole, rimasti ancora incompiuti, abbandonati, ti ho dato la mia anima, lasciami il mio nome, perché quando la libertà verrà a chiamare e io non ho un nome da poter chiamare, come potrò essere liberato? Io ti ho dato la mia anima, lasciami il mio nome.
I have pledged allegiance to a fully masted, half-flaccid flag, and to the republic which stands not, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I have prayed your Lord's prayer to your God, made in your image, to deliver me from your evils. But hallowed be his name, no will for black prayers to be done on his earth, nor as it is in his gated heaven. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. After all my toils, frets, and fears, suffered 2 score and 17 years, all my blood, sweat, and tears poured into every valley you've forsaken me in, I've sung my country 'tis of thee when you said sing. I have at your twilight's last gleaming held your broad stripes and bright stars waving over land you proclaimed to be free and home of the brave, not yet brave enough to let all men be free. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. I believe your claim that Columbus, with certain navigational precision, sailed west to find India sitting in the east and discovered a continent not lost, nor looking to be found, inhabited by men not lost, nor looking to be found, and he renamed them a new name other than their own name. I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. Because if freedom comes a calling and I have no name to be called, how will I be freed? Leave me my name. I believe you when you proclaim Jefferson professed with loving tenderness that her rape, slave rape, plantation rape, socioeconomic rape was consensual. I believe your lie that Washington never told a lie, that it was a civil war fought by civil men to free uncivilized slaves that Lincoln, without fraught, presided over so that this nation could claim yet a second new birth of freedom, a second new claim to be a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. To these yet unfinished and abandoned words and work, I have given you my soul. Because when freedom comes a calling, and I have no name to be called, how will I be free? I have given you my soul. Leave me my name. I spent 13 years becoming an eye surgeon, a minimum of 13 years. Only at the end of 13 years did I really find out what I progressed from and to. And it was from nigger to Dr. Nigger. Dr. Nigger. Dr. Nigger, can you cure me without touching me with nigger hands? Can you save my life without changing my life? Can you dance soft shoe while humming those Negro tunes when my white life codes blue? Can you reach inside yourself beyond the shit we put in you, past painful moments we put in you, past despair and hopelessness we put in you, and find that old black magic in you to save my life without changing all the shit we put in you? Dr. Nigger, can you breathe in me air free of nigger from a nigger not free enough to breathe in free air? Can you stay on the colored side of the colored line and reach across your woes and without touching me with those nigger hands to restart my blue heart without changing my cold heart? Can you reach past the life we've taken from you and save my life without letting the white light pass me by? Can you, Dr. Nigger, be bigger for just 1 minute, in it for more than just a minute to save my life without taking my life? Can you cure me without touching me with those nigger hands? Can you dance soft shoe while humming Negro tunes while you save my life without changing my life when my white life codes blue? I was asked to do a reading in Oregon, in the States, and the assignment was they would give you one word and you had to present a poem based on this one word. Unfortunately, they didn't look into your body of work to see whether that poem existed within your body of work, and it did not. So the word was veneer. This is my response to that assignment. Veneer, artificial perfection. evenly spread superficially across surface irregularities, concealing surface inner imperfections, outward manifestations of inner fears, of fear and choreographed lies we dance around to spin around the truth. An ill-fitted, counterfeit, $100 bill stretched to fit over a folded wad of ones. A forged friendly smile laminated the surface of our hate. A smooth, silky satin sock we weave to cover rough feet we dance around the truth upon. Veneer. This laminate, this conceived, hell-resistant, immaculate conception we fabricate to wear, to cover our trail, to cover our tails, to cover when we steal, when we kill, when we bear false witness in the dark abyss beneath the surface of those loosely adherent, layered laminates. Thou shall not steal. Thou shall not kill. Thou shall not bear false witness. Veneer, marquee masquerading mask of cleansing and rebirth, facades that are no more than a more pleasing appearance, no more than a more desirable surface material of skim coat surface lies, thinly coating who we really are, lurking beneath the lies of soul cleansing and rebirth. Veneer. This inlay of two, overlying one, added on top to divide the one into two halves. One was never meant to be a you, a me, a wrong, a right, a black, a white, synthesized black light, emitting fluorescent composites of manufactured darkness, casting unenlightened shadows. We hide our surface woes beneath. Veneered, we are manufactured mannequins, still life surface paragons dressed up in monogram window dressings, facades beneath which we bleed, sanguineous denials shrouded in diaphanous layers of artificial truths we cover our true selves in to appear more loving in our false love, more tolerant in our synthetic tolerance, more human in our inhumane inhumanity we falsely appear to be to cover up what we have become. An ill-fitted, counterfeit, $100 bill stretched to fit over a folded wad of ones. A forged friendly smile laminated the surface of our hate. A smooth, silky satin sock we weaved to cover rough feet we dance around the truth upon. Appalling silence. It was inspired by Martin Luther King. I'm informed and influenced a lot by Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Gandhi, and Michael Jackson. And one of the things that Martin Luther King said that it was not the strident clamor of the bad people. It is the appalling silence of the good people. And as much as I traveled around the world, I've come to believe that the problem is not the bad people. The problem is the so-called good people who sit in silence. Not just sit in silence, but they benefit from that silence. And that's why they sit in silence, because of the benefits. It is not the night, but the absence of light. It is not the sweltering fervor of the desert, but the rainfall that fails to fall. It's not humanity that loses its humanity, taking, denying humanity from its fellow man, but humanity that fails to find its humanity, fighting back, to give back, to grant back humanity seen, taken, denied its fellow man. It's not the strident clamor nor the vitriolic voices of the bad people, but the appalling silence of those who claim to be the good people. It is not the night, but the absence of light that keeps us in the dark. And in the end, we must remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Van Gogh Eyes, Van Gogh's Eyes. This is the first time I've read this one. Somebody picked this one to be read. And if you know her, you cannot say no to her.
I know.
Van Gogh's Eyes. Canvased eyes, watching passing portrait heads, pausing their moment's view, the palette of my ills painted a deep blue, brushed the Van Gogh indigo, refusing to let go its hold this dismayed soul. Canvas eyes watching their view of cued, paused, colored views, passing one after the other in tilted frames, framing tilted heads hung from tilted walls, not seeing still the littered linen landscape. Wilted flowers are hung, put to galleries and corridors of closed doors and mines of morning fields of amber-gray rage. Set ablaze to swirl a violent haze of hues, refusing to change their colored views of hued, weathered faces, hung in portrait pane, hung on empty walls to watch portrait passers passing by, pausing, refusing to see still, in canvased eyes, hung, frameless head, a nameless wall, these Van Gogh's eyes watching. And the last one, I wrote this from Rome while being here. And I was thinking a lot about form. I did Tai Chi for a number of years, and my Tai Chi teachers used to always say that I'm teaching you this pattern, but I don't want you to become this form. It's a way of learning to be and to move and to think and to feel without predetermined form and an immediacy to your movement. So it got me thinking about form and the discipline of form. It is this chrysalis, this crucible that sets wings to butterflies to fly, this cistern of rivers that opens seas, the shaft from which ground grist of grain are freed. This cyst eternity lifts itself out of. Form is the discipline, this crucible through which we lose the constraints of form. Form is the way to open seas, the way out the chrysalis. It is the discipline of form, that shape of mouth that frees the lips to kiss beyond the shape of lips and mouth. It is the breast milk, not the mother's breast, that feeds us, forms us, frees us from the mother's breast. Form is the way out of form. It is the underground railroad, not the destination, freeing the artist from the rails of the road. Form is the path to formlessness, the gist of being, the crucible that sets wings to butterflies to fly through open seas. I'm open for questions, comments. Yes, ma'am.
I've got several questions. I didn't speak well.
they always start with that.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Okay. So I have several questions. Like, the first one is how you actually started writing poems. Like, what inspired you to write poems? And the second one is, like, why do you think racial discrimination still exists in America, and how could it possibly be addressed? And the third question is, have you ever met Maya Angelou in America?
Okay. Take them backward. No, I have not met Maya Angelou. I'd love to do that. How did I get started? Let me try to do that real short. I believed in the American dream. I believed it probably more than any other American. I came from humble beginnings. I was taught that education was the way out, the key. It was very important. I believed in all the heroes that we were taught as kids, Washington, Jefferson, the whole bit. Lincoln was my hero. I memorized the Gettysburg Address. I can still recite a good portion of the Gettysburg Address right now. But what I realized after some 13, 14 years of education, that the thing that really mattered the most with respect to, in my case, a person of color, and in your case it would be a woman, was the color of my skin. That dictated everything. And that no matter what I achieved, I will always be defined first and diminished to some measure by the color of my skin. So my degree, my medical degree, my surgical eye degree from Harvard is less than my white colleagues who graduated from the program, because I'm treated different and diminished on site by the color of my skin. That was a painful realization, to wake up to that at midlife, or a little less than midlife, and to come to grips with that, to face that, when you believe so deeply and so passionately in the American dream and freedom, justice, and equality, and that many of those things are just words in this world. Your second question was?
Actually, I wanted to have the first question. So you don't think that the fact that America has a black place that doesn't change anything in stereotypes?
I think the fact that you have to ask that question answers it. The political system is entrenched around the world, so not in America, it's entrenched. The political powers are only going to allow it to move a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right, irrespective of your color or gender. That's a system that's entrenched. When you come to it, you have to play their game or they get rid of you. Either by giving you some assignment that's so meaningless in the basement of the halls of Congress, or shooting you in the head. So just the mere fact that he's working within that structure, he's limited in terms of what he could do, if one hasn't already sold out to some degree in order to get to that position. And the number one constituent is not the people. It's the persons, for the most part, who finance you. And that's your first constituent. Be you black, blue, green, or yellow. But you had a second question.
Yeah, it was about how could this problem possibly be addressed?
The problem of... To me, it's not a problem of color. It's not a problem of gender. It's not a problem of age or sexual orientation. To me, these are the tools that are used. The problem is an economic problem, one of greed. Okay. And how do I maximize money? A very greedy capitalist. One is by creating and institutionalizing differences And then when we have these differences, you got to then say, you got to assign a value to them, greater or less, which then allows you to exploit, to feel comfortable exploiting and degrading for economic reasons. All this is about economics. Black slaves were brought to America for purely for economic reasons. Slaves all over the world are slaves purely for economic reasons. You got white masters, slave masters. You got black slave masters. You have Asian black slave masters. This is not an issue of color. It's an issue of economics. So having said that, if economics is the major reason for this, economics has to be a major part of the solution in dealing with this. So we have a couple examples of that in history. When Martin Luther King did the Montgomery bus boycott, and blacks refused to ride the bus, and then eventually they were given the right to sit anywhere on the bus that they liked. That whole success story was wrapped in a religious package. Okay, God saved us, God came down, God spoke to their hearts to do the right thing. But if you read between the lines, it was all about economics. The bus company lost money. The businesses downtown where the bus would take blacks to spend money lost money. It was the white businesses that put pressure on the bus company to let blacks get on the bus and sit with everyone. The answer was right there, but it got lost in the religious rhetoric. And a lot of our leaders do not want us to understand that, particularly black leaders, because they're making a whole lot of money keeping us in place, thinking that we can win this thing by changing hearts and minds. You cannot change the heart and mind of an amoral person. What you need to do is change their behavior. And you change their behavior by what motivates their behavior in the first place. And what motivates their behavior is economics. So we're coming to a battlefield with pitchforks, when all we have to do is come together, one heart, one mind, one soul, collective $1, and direct our spending habits in a way in which we change their behaviors, not their hearts and minds. Who cares about that? I'm going to change the behavior. Get your foot off my back. We can hug later, but right now I want you to get your foot off my back. And the way I do that is I have to pay you, because that's what moves you. So there's your answer.
Actually, in that story, it was more, I think, about solidarity, because...
I'm sorry?
In that case, in Alabama State, the bus focus, it started with a woman, I forgot her name, who...
Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks.
Yeah, but, like, other people refused to sit in the bus in solidarity with her. So, I guess the first comes the solidarity and the courage to protest, and then...
Yeah, but you gotta have. No, that's wrong, in my mind. Excuse me. You know what that is what I call the beautiful car. Oh, it's so beautiful, brand new car. It's just lovely. Okay, and then you get in the car, you have no gas. Where are you going? So the car represents your ideas and your ideals, but you have no power. So it's about power. Cares that Rosa, they didn't give a fart about Rosa Parks. What they cared about and what changed things, and you asked me how to change. You didn't ask me to make it sound romantic. You asked me how to change things. And how you make the car go is with gas. And so the struggle must be with gas, economics. $1 collectively as we spin our habits. Every time a white person gets on TV and accidentally says nigger because they thought the mic was off, what you'll see is they come back on TV a week or two later crying, apologizing, because the sponsors are ready to pull out money. They may get their show pulled, money. So somebody in America said, it's economics, dummies. It's always been about economics. And who know that better than our politicians? And who's hiding money where?
Thank you.
You're welcome, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I don't think I need a mic. Okay, can you hear me? Yesterday, I was talking to a representative of the consulate, the American consulate in Milan, and they didn't know about this meeting, and I wondered why. So now I know why.
Well, tell me why. Since you know why, tell me why.
Okay, and I wanted to know...
You're not going to answer my question?
I think it's... I don't need to. Do I?
I want to know.
Well, I mean, they don't like antagonism.
Oh, antagonism. Yeah. They don't like.
I don't think they like antagonism.
Even though they antagonize, they don't like antagonism.
I mean...
Why is it antagonism? Why? No, let me hold it. Why is it antagonism? I was in Rome speaking, and I came in early, and I heard three people talking. They call themselves leftists, whatever that means. But the one was describing herself as a radical. And I thought, why are you describing and defining yourself as the radical? Somebody comes in your house, robs, rapes, beats, steals. You respond to that. And then you call yourself and you let them define you as a radical. They're the radicals. We call ourselves militants. We're not the militants. We are the response to militancy. We are this response to people being radical. And see, this whole language of slavery, this whole lexicon of lies and this, it's the way they control us and the way they brainwash us. So you have to be careful.
Yeah.
You have to be careful with their language.
I agree, but I mean, only progressive narratives of freedom in the U.S. are accepted at the public level. And
what does that mean in English?
is it too abstract?
Yeah, for me, I'm not that bright. So what does that mean?
If you say, look how far we have gone, it's okay. If you point out that...
Who said it's okay?
Well, it's okay for the rhetorical, the self-identity projected. I mean, Barack Obama had to do this in many of his speeches. He had to resort to a rhetorical strategy that has been part of African-American rhetorical strategies to see... to emphasize the idea of progress, still to be achieved, but still there.
Let me tell you what I think about progress. Progress and strides are no more than freedom denied and incremental steps of progress and strides. I can say that again.
Can you?
Yeah. Progress and strides are no more than freedom denied and incremental steps of progress and strides. Martin Luther King said, now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. He didn't say 3 hours from now or 2 weeks or anything like that. In the Declaration of Independence, they said, now is a necessity. They didn't deal with progress and strides. Progress and strides steals our thunder. It steals the moments, the minutes of urgency. We have lost urgency in the struggle. And you can water it down with progress and strides. Oh, it's okay. We've had some progress. I want to be free now. Whatever that is and however you define it, I want it now. I don't want it in progress and strides. While every incremental step of that way, you're making money while I'm waiting. So again, you have to be careful with their language. It is chosen for specific reasons. And much of that is to put us to sleep.
It's like what you said about the word hope.
That's what I say about hope. I don't believe in hope. We should get rid of hope. I didn't hope I would get through school. I got through school. I didn't sit and hope. Hope, again, is like progress and strides. It dilutes urgency. It stops you from acting now, because I hope it'll happen.
Can I come to my question?
I'm sorry, I thought I answered that. I apologize.
What I wanted to ask you was had to do with activism, and I was wondering whether you consider poetry a good tool for activism, and whether you supplement it with other kinds of activism. Do you do readings in schools, for example, or whatever?
Yeah, I read wherever I can. I think any and everything that you can use that's legal and creates harmony should be used for activism. Or yeah, should be. I was going to get into activism, but I'll leave that alone. I think you use any and everything you get your hands on that's legal to fight. But I think, as I said before, the most powerful tool to fight with is economics, collective economics. And every time one government gets ticked off at another government, what do? Economic boycott. Why are we missing this? Why are we missing this in our struggle? Black, white, blue, green, female, why are we missing this? Because we're taught money is bad. Money isn't bad. People are bad, and they use money in bad ways. So that says to me that good people can use money in good ways. It's the medium of exchange of power in the world. And in order to free yourself, you need power. Freedom is not free. There's a cost to obtain it, and then there's a cost to sustain it. Freedom is not free anywhere in the world. I don't believe there's any democracy anywhere. I believe instead of democracy, what we have are varying degrees of tyranny. Yes, ma'am. Yes, she's the first. Yeah.
Thank you. I liked your reading. And you're right, power is what needs to be addressed in these various forms of power. Certainly an economic one, but language is also power. And I think poetry and the verse that you read just now definitely are tools of empowerment. And one thing I wanted to say, to go back to poetry for 1 second, what you read for me has all the voices of the Black Atlantic inside. And there's Aimé Césaire, and there's Frantz Fanon. Do you know them?
I've heard that before, yeah. Thank you, that's pretty nice.
But the idea is that the question of naming and the question of healing bodies when you are a Black man, this is what comes through your verse, and this is what Frantz Fanon, being a psychiatrist, for example, experienced. And I just wanted to ask whether that was some source of inspiration for you or not. Frantz Fanon or Césaire?
No. I learned about those individuals only after writing. This has come purely from me. When I first started the first book, and I was being pushed and encouraged to actually create it as a book, one of the first persons who were supposedly knowledgeable about poetry and what's good poetry and what's not good poetry I met with her after she read the manuscript, and one of the things, I was just really hating, well, one, I wanted it to be good news. Two, if it was good news, what I thought I would hear second was, I want you to read this person, read this person, read that person, read this person. Well, that's a problem in part for me because I have a reading dyslexia, so it takes me a long time to read and understand things. So I was struggling with that. But what she said was, I don't want you to read anything. I just want you to keep writing. Do not read anything. And I'm like, whoa, that's nice. And then I said, why? Why? And she just said, there's a style there that I'm picking up, and I want you to write and write until you perceive and understand your style and know who you are. And then you can read other people. And when you do, and you're inspired by other people, you can bring them back to your words and your wordplay. And so that's what I did. And so that's why I'm not too familiar with a lot of this, because I come out of a science background. I'm a scientist for the most part.
I was just thinking of Caliban in Césaire the Tempest. And when he comes on stage, he says, call me X. Because I am a man whose name has been stolen. Yes. And that's what the connection I was making to your poem. That's all.
Thank you. And I agree, language, poetry, all that stuff is power. That's what you say power, I say tools. Because the power is the economics. The language and the poetry is the car. You still need gas to run them. So you can have beautiful words and powerful poetry, but to the amoral heart and ear, they don't care. They don't care because it's about economics. And so if you want to move them, you got to have gas in the car. So I see that as the ultimate power for addressing their behavior. And when I think of these things as tools, race, our gender, language, poetry, it allows me to put them in their proper place, but also allows me to make sure that the economics is paramount in this struggle. Because that's the one thing that's missing. The one big thing that's missing in our struggle is collective economics. One mind, one heart, one soul, $1.
Well, $1 is a dream of Americans.
Well, I'm not dreaming it as an American. I'm dreaming it as
Not of you, but, you know, yeah. American power, $1 in all over the world.
Well, I don't have a specific question, but mine is like I want to engage in a brief conversation to understand a curiosity I've had since we last saw in Rome. And basically, the opening statement you made about how your writings are contextually, they deal in a contextual framework whereby it's a narrative of black and white. So I kind of identify with that, but at the same
time... You can or cannot?
I can identify with that, but I feel a certain disconnect from the reality from which you write from, the inspirations or the experiences you've had. So when you read, I feel I can connect with what I can imagine what it looks like or what it was for you. But at the same time, I feel like the struggle that I myself as a young person living in the 21st century, whatever, face is much more than what most people would like to admit. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that from a personal point of view, it's not only a narrative of black and white for me. I identify myself as black, obviously, as a student, as an immigrant, as a socially disadvantaged person, more or less, you know, and in many ways, even I can say also as a young graduate, like most of the people here are all students, and we don't have a clue of what we have to do afterwards, after our graduation. And that, I feel, it's something, it's a struggle. It's a struggle for everybody. And so my question is this, or my conversation I want to have with you is, considering that economics is the root of all trouble, if one can say that, you know, how can the new generation, with all the enormous obstacles we have to face, you know, because it's different for us to integrate in the labor force, and the labor force obviously has economics in the background because that's where money comes from. So if you work, you make money. So now, most of my colleagues are stranded in the work, like after graduation. So I'm trying to understand, my first priority is, how do I make it after, as a person, not as a black person, not as a student, not as as an immigrant, but how do I make it as a person? And my first thought goes to, well, you have to survive. So if I have to survive, I have to work. So now, for most people my age now, it's difficult to get a work because it's different. The context has evolved from what it was in the 20th century. We have technology nowadays. We have, you know, you can have job interviews via Skype or whatever. So it makes the process and the competition even higher because everybody's familiar with the tools and everybody has a very different skill set. And that makes the competition very, 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 very hard. So what I'm trying to understand is, considering youth empowerment, the disconnection between identity, origin, all those things mixed together, how can somebody who hasn't actually found himself yet cope and at the same time understand that the real challenge does not lie where, how do you put it, is not in the beautiful, in the romantics of the reality we live in, you know, but actually, as you say quite clearly, in the root of economics. So many people are kind of do not understand this. They see it some, they identify with other priorities. But after we talked in Rome, I started thinking, like, if you are right, then economics it's at the top of the pyramid. Then every other thing is just there. It's like a stepping stone to get to the top, and it's
the
yeah.
Top of what?
Exactly. That's my question. What's the top? What's at the top? Because I think at the top of the economics, there's always something else there. It can't be all about economics.
Yeah, my narratives are never about it all being about economics, and that the thing that that's it, at the end of that rainbow is economics. What I'm saying, it is a tool, it is a powerful tool, a weapon, to get to whatever you think is at the end of that economics. For me, it's freedom, it's equality, it's justice. It's an opportunity to rise and fall on my own merits and not the color of my skin. Nothing in this world is guaranteed to you and for you, except it should be an equal opportunity to rise and fall on your own merits. And I think that's very important. A lot of what you said in there was I. It is not just about you. It's about what we can do together. So maybe you need to start thinking bigger in terms of how we can work together to overcome some of those barriers that you and that you're facing, that many of us faced also. We all run out and try to do this individual thing. But if you heard what I said, one heart, one mind, one soul, one dollar. That means collectively. Working collectively together. They asked me this question in India, the Dalits, which is the lower caste. And they said, well, what can we do? We don't have money. We don't have that kind of money. But you can start somewhere. And what I told him was, take your pennies. There's obviously a merchant right outside your ghetto that's treating you badly, treating you with disrespect, gouging you with prices. Collectively decide not to buy from him and buy over here. Change his behavior. Start there. But it's You got to do it collectively, and you got to start thinking collectively. Money is not the end point here.
So, okay, I understand what the suggestion you just made, but I have a counter to that. For example, like when it comes to collectivity in general, people have different priorities. That's what I was trying to emphasize when I was talking for the past 5 minutes.
So
without
there's the problem. You stop right there. There's the problem.
Yeah.
If you understand, we're all in the same boat. We're all in here because of being exploited for economic reasons. Now, all these other little things on the side which you have that separate us and make us separate and distinct and keep us at each other's throats and doesn't allow us to come together, then you'll sink with that. Common enemy makes common friends.
So
first, empower yourself. Understand to empower yourself, to come together collectively. All this identity, what's the buzzword that they use now? It drives me crazy. Identity politics. It's the biggest bunch of crap. And all we're doing is dividing ourselves among ourselves. We're doing their job. They don't care. So you've got to come together. Somehow, some way, we've got to come together and see the power of our collective economics. You got to start out with a good heart. You got to understand why we're doing this. You got to understand that we're brothers and sisters, that we, even though our differences are our strengths, we can't come together, try to come together with all this notion of, you know, this is mine, this is mine, this is me, this is where I am. We have something in common with respect to making it very difficult for us to have an equal opportunity to rise or fall on our own merits.
That's perfectly clear to me, as you just explained. Yeah, but what I was trying to say was, I believe it was easier to rally people under one cause for a collective mission, for a collective objective in the past, rather than now in the 21st century, because there is like a polarization of everybody's priority.
I don't know if that's true. I don't necessarily know that that's true. Oh, we can talk. But what I can't do and what I will not do was create or personalize a roadmap for you. That's not what I'm here for. That's not what I'm here for. And let me just say quickly, American blacks, black Americans collectively have $917 billion of liquidity. That means in their pockets, from poor to rich. If we came together more and directed that $917 billion to change behavior, we'd be much further along than we are now. But we're all pulled apart. So we could just come together to say, here's where we're just going to spend our money. I say buy black or buy from that does right by black right now. Take that and run with it. Get on the streets of Rome and run with that. And you can remove black and put whatever you want in there.
Yeah.
And that's the nice thing I like about that. You can remove black and anything else fits in there. It's where you spend your money collectively.
Young people, old age pensioners, women, and so on. Whatever.
More questions?
Okay. And okay, thank you so much for reading with us your poems. And I mean, I have a question that is some way connected with the previous one, and it concerns your conception of your role as a poet in society. So in the poem Appealing Silence, you use the beautiful image of absence of light. So my question is, according to you, which is the role of poetry in contrasting this absence of light and in making humanity finds its humanity also in a collective way.
Wow. All I can do is speak from my heart, what I feel, what I believe, and if it touches you and it means something to you and it inspires you to do something, then you know, the words worked, at least for you. If it does not, then that's okay. I first write at the risk of the I first write for me. I write to save me, to get what's in me out, to put words and meanings to the emotions, good ones, bad ones, that I feel and experience and think about. And then I'm willing to share them. And then whatever you get out of it or do with it, you know, that's good. I think everything in life is poetry, not just the words on this page. Everything is poetry. Your teacher's a poet. Translator's a poet. Miss India's a poet.
Are politicians also?
Yes, they are. So again, I didn't assign a negative or positive value to it. So you could be a bad poet and saying negative things. Okay. So the question is, what value do we assign to that? To what you being. But why did you ask that question?
Is Donald Trump a poet?
There's a certain amount of poetry in there, yes. 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 That's it. Come on, people.
So, last question. What is your ambition, like, your ambition right now?
My ambition right now?
Outside of poetry, what is it that inspires you at the moment? Where are you going? What is your objective?
I'm putting one foot in front of the other and see where I go. That's. I live in the moment. I wait for the moment to speak to me, and then I translate it or transcribe it. And that's it. I want to write. I want to think. Bob Marley said it very well. He said, my head is me home. And that's where I camp out. I want to be in my head and to think and feel. Not outside of the world. I need to walk through the world and have the world... and engage the world and have it engage me so that I can feel it, even the sadness of it, and then hopefully I'll put something to paper that can memorialize that. And if I can then also have dialogues like this, that, you know, we go back and forth and I learn from you and hopefully you learn something from me, then that will continue my growth as a human being, as a part of humanity. But I think it's important to live, at least for me at this stage, to live in the moment as much as I possibly can. Life is so short, so I like to live in the moment and take it from there.
And so you don't plan to be engaged in a political movement to come closer to your goal of...
Hell no. Did you hear what I just said earlier? That's the worst place... Sorry, maybe I shouldn't say that. I'm uninvited, I see. I personally think the political circle is the worst to go. It's too corrupt. It's too entrenched all over the world.
But how can you achieve change?
You change out on the street. Out on the street. Governments have been moved by people out in the street. And how you spend your money collectively. Mm-hmm. Politicians need money to get into office. Somebody understands that. That's why they're financing them. Somebody understands that. That's why they're financing them. And they know that when those politicians get in office, they're going to come back and, you know, what's the Bible say? You get it 20 folds or something like that. You get it back. So, I believe if you do the politics things, you got to do it from a standpoint of having capital to influence. What do they call it in America? We call it lobbying.
Lobbying.
Bribery. Okay, it's how we play with words. If I do it, it's a bribe. But we call it a lobbyist. You know, we take the dinner, the movies, the shows, pay for your candidacy. So I think it's important only because it's a necessary evil. But it is not the answer for me. If it was the answer, we've had centuries and centuries and centuries of politics, and we're sitting in the room now asking the question. I think the professor wants to go at my throat for a minute.
No, just following your reasoning, but it seems to me that in a sense you are proposing sort of strategic
way of doing. I mean, you say in order to overcome the problems, including the trouble that Anthony was mentioning, you know, with young people and so on, you have to act collectively. You have to transform your I into a we. Okay, so is it isn't it something like engaging in politics? Maybe not that kind of politics, you know, but another, an alternative way of doing politics, or not acting collectively. And another way of rephrasing the typical utopia that we have gone through for centuries? No, there is politics, there is powers and so on, but there is also another way of doing things, behaving in using the power.
Yes.
So you are proposing another way of doing policy, politics.
No, I'm saying, I'm saying, first what you have to do is what I do is I understand that we are brothers and sisters, irrespective of our differences. I see our differences as our strength. If you can turn water on and I can turn water off, our differences, and we're in the desert, and we work together with our differences, we will never thirst. Okay, so I see our differences as our strength. And we're all brothers and sisters with respect to that. Now I forgot the point I was trying to make. When we engage with respect to politicians and things like that, we must do it from a standpoint of understanding that we are brothers and sisters, okay? And we must do that. And so then when we take this power that we have, the economic power, to try to then change the behavior, we change the behavior hopefully in a way that respects the underpinnings of our relationship, which is that we respect each other. And so I'm not going to not give him an opportunity because he's black. I'm going to give him an opportunity because he's qualified, and let him rise or fall on his own merit. And we don't do that here. Not just with color, but with gender, age, sexuality, the whole bit. So if we're going to move the politicians, we can do that. If we're going to engage them, we can do that. But you cannot engage them with heart. They don't care about that. You can't engage them on what is right and do the right thing because it's right. If that's the case, we wouldn't be here. And many of the problems of the world wouldn't exist for centuries. We're not engaging them in the right kind of way. Someone asked me about voting. I've never voted and I never will vote. I will never go into a booth and pull a lever. What I've done is I've handed the money right in the hand of the politician. They'll remember you. When you make that call, they'll remember you and your cause. voting for the lesser of two evils, the lesser of two evils is still evil. Change the paradigm. When one part of the political party doesn't like what the other part of the political party is doing, what do they do? Excuse me? No, who said that?
Anthony.
Say it again. And what is filibuster?
They try to obstruct
what? The vote. The vote. So when they don't like what the other one's doing, they don't vote. But when we don't like it, we're told to go vote. It's our sacred right. No, your sacred right is to hold that vote until you have something worthy of casting it for. The lesser of two evils is still evil. The young lady has a question in the back. She hasn't had a question yet. Yes.
Well, thank you. Mine is not really a question. It's more just ideas, okay?
Ideas.
Yes, because reflecting on your words, I thought of the past. Martin Luther King, and you quoted King in your reading, he talked about civil rights. And then we have Malcolm, who talked about human rights. And I was wondering if we should, and here we are in the Human Rights Center of the university, so a symbolical place maybe, but maybe we should move and talk about economic rights then, according to your what you're telling us. And that is a passage that is, you can read in the lines of both King's writings and X's writings, but we never, sometimes we forget to talk about that when we use this great man as...
Well, a lot of that is because we've been taught not to think about those aspects, okay? We've been taught not to think about... We get the romanticized version of that, the heart, the mind, all that stuff. And instead of calling it economic rights, which is important, I would rather call it economic might. Because you can still have the right, but that right doesn't necessarily move you to the might, coalescing enough to be able to then change people's behaviors. As you try to change their behaviors with your heart and mind, they don't listen. Then you have this greater tool which changes people's behaviors. And really, it's right now, it's about changing behavior. Class?
Yeah, because we talk about money, but I was thinking of work class instead. I don't know if...
I don't see any need for that. No. I mean, because then if it's class, then what's the other end of that? I'm very cautious about labels. I get caught into them myself, but I'm very cautious about labels. We're people. I think this young lady had to.
Well, my question is about the media. We were talking earlier about changing behavior and going to the street and, you know, influencing people's collective priorities. So I was wondering, how does the media, who are supposed to be covering the independent aspects of daily life? You know, so how do they fix and how do they fit in into this process? Because evidently the power brokers, the big money people, they are the media tycoons nowadays. So there's no independence in the media anymore. So I was wondering, how does that fix in when we have to, obviously living in the age of the 21st century where you have social media that's independent on its own, but how do all these things work together? Like you have...
Yeah. The social media has helped a lot because, again, we can share ideas and talk about things independent of established mainstream media. My feeling, they're all in bed together. That's one. Two, media is a business. It's a business. And a business does what? Profits. And so by any means possible. So who said 90% of the news on TV should be bad news? Who said that? Why are we given bad news all the time? Creates fear. You stay in tune between the commercials. You know, it's about selling you stuff between the news. Okay? And if the politicians are in part part of the system that establishes what you can and cannot do as a media conglomerate, then you're going to be somewhat in bed with them. I've seen where, you know, certain people are being interviewed and they're just softball after softball after softball because those individuals have some measure of power. And then you get someone, any one of us, to get on there and they will flatten us, ask those direct questions that should be asked, those follow-up questions that should be asked. They're not asked the people with influence. So I don't necessarily trust media. I very rarely do anything with mainstream media. And I think social media has been a great, great help to us because you can have a voice. You can have a voice. I mean, there's just a lot of crap out there. There's a lot of crap out everywhere. But you can have a voice. And you can unite with like-minded voices. You can find people who agree with you and you can, you know, discuss that. Or you can find people who do not agree with you and you can discuss that and grow. So I think social media has helped a lot. I'm afraid.
Of the economic power of Black Americans and the possibility of using boycott as a strategy, which reminded me of Malcolm X's nationalism, the idea of buying within the ghetto or using the money.
Assuming all Black people lived in the ghetto.
Just back then, exactly.
Oh, back then?
That's my point.
Yes.
I mean, as much as I like this, as I share this idea, I don't see it very likely that people like Will Smith or Beyoncé engage in this kind of boycott.
Why do we need them? Why do we need them? That's wrong.
They're part of
But what did I tell you? $917 billion. Moses did not take all the Jews to the promised land. Okay? He did not take everyone that started with him on Exodus, did not arrive with him on the day of arrival. Cannot try to take everybody and get everybody in the wagon. That's why we can't move. We have an idea where, say, 85% good, okay? But we always get hit with, especially people on the left, with, no, that's not a good idea because we didn't save everybody. There's a little fable. I was in church once, and the preacher was saying, he was using the metaphor of the shepherd as Jesus and the sheep as people. And the shepherd was taking the flock to the pasture, the promised land, heaven. And two sheep ran off. The shepherd then left the 98 to go get the two. So I'm sitting there, I'm saying, whoa, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense at all. And everybody in church, oh, yeah, I I'm that too that got lost. He's going to come find me. I'm like, crap, no. Get the 98 to the promised land. Build the socio-economic infrastructure for the promised land. And maybe those two will find you.
But what if those two have 70% of the economic power?
They don't.
Well,
okay, I'll answer you that.
I'm not so sure.
But if they don't join your cause and they don't believe in what you're doing, then what good is their money? Okay, what good is their money? Like-minded. You remember what I said? One heart, one soul, one mind. That's where it starts. Can't get everybody to the promised land. We'll never get started. One of the things, I love the movie The Ten Commandments. And I'm not religious at all, but I love the movie The Ten Commandments. We used to wait every year for it. And this one year, something happened. It clicked. And what I noticed was, again, Moses getting ready to take the nation of Israel to the promised land. And the camera pans, and you see someone else picking up the old lady and putting her in the wagon. Someone else gathering the chickens. Someone else getting the tools and the gold and all that stuff. And then it pans and there's Moses standing there. And I looked at the relationship of how Moses was standing to the people. And I thought, that's how you lead. And how do you lead? You lead with your ass facing the people. Okay? That means you're looking at the promised land and you're leading them. And not everyone made it to the promised land. Can't get everyone. Can't get there. I'd rather go with five good warriors. Five good warriors. I'd rather start that process that was talking about with two good warriors than trying to get, 100 people. Okay? Excuse me? Oh,
is this a new paradigm?
Politics. Don't say that with me. I didn't say anything
about leading people to the promised land.
No, it's a vision that I the kind of thing.
But put it in practice.
Not that type of politics.
Okay.
Not that type of politics. Okay, Martin Luther King led in many respects by showing his rear to the people. He took them. Okay. And Malcolm X, in many respects, led that kind of way. Okay, you have to be committed. Someone has to be committed to seeing the horizon of the promised land. And in the black community, so many of us, once we reach a certain level of education, and what I call miseducation, really, because that's about what most of that is. Once we reach a certain level, what are we asked to do? We're asked to go back to the high school. So I'm a physician. I asked to go back to the high school and speak to C-minus students to encourage them that maybe they could be a doctor. No. What I should be asked to do is to come to the community and I work together, that I build a medical facility in that community, bringing other doctors in, so that we build the kind of social economic infrastructure that will allow us to come to the table to be heard. Okay? So use your resources properly. And it's not political, it's just, it just makes sense to me. You're not going to have your roofer come and do your plumbing. And I don't put everything in the framework of politics.
They do a lot in Italy, though.
They do a lot all over the world.
They are, yeah.
Yeah, they do a lot all over the world. I saw it a lot in India.
Mm. Yeah. It's true. I think we're finished.
Yeah. Did you have? Yes.
No.
I thought you had one.
Okay.
I thank you all very much for your patience.
Thank you.